And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and we have something a bit different and special today. I was recently invited to be in conversation with one of America's greatest writers, Gail Godwin, at Parnassus Books in Nashville, Tennessee. Ms. Godwin was on tour with her latest novel, The Grief Cottage, which is published by Bloomsbury. I had some technical difficulties with my recording microphone, so the sound isn't as good as we normally have on Book Talk, but it is a wonderful conversation with Ms. Godwin.
What happened to our narrator, Marcus, when he was 11 years, 5 months, and 4 days old?
Well, he remembered it. That's why the book starts that way, because his mother died that night. She was going out to get them a pizza. They were very poor, and she was working 3 jobs, and it was an icy winter night, and she went out to get them a pizza because they were going to watch one of their favorite movies, which was about 3 thieves who posed as musicians. And they rent a room from a nice old lady and close the door and put a record on the gramophone, and she's never the wiser. And then as the movie goes on, she's helping them move the stolen goods through, and she's never the wiser. His mother does not come home. She has turned over the car, and she's dead, and that's it.
And Flora, Helen's mother, had passed away. And Melancholy's daughter, the lead character's mother, left the family and then died in a car accident as well.
Oh, my.
And I think there's one other novel, I can't remember, but the girl goes to private school and her mother had died. And that's one of the reasons she'd gone to private school. I was just wondering why the death of a mother has been kind of a starting point for you in several of your novels.
I don't know, because my mother didn't die until quite late in her life and my life, but she did die in a car accident. Once a New York Times book reviewer, Christopher Lehman Holt, wrote, "Gail Godwin's books are ships with dead fathers in the hold." So there you get the other sense.
Well, and with these books that have the mothers passing away, the fathers aren't really available. Melancholy's daughter, he's massively depressed at the passing
right.
of his wife. In our current book, Marcus's father is unknown to him.
Right.
Completely.
That's right. Unknown.
After his mother passes away, he's put in state care for a while. It's tolerable, but it's less than ideal as well.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about parable parties and the supposed fun that's supposed to be held at the parable party.
Now, how long is he in foster care?
Let's see. A few months.
A few months, till he finishes school. He's finishing 7th grade because he skipped a grade. He's smart. And he is boarded with this foster family, this cheerful foster family, who loves the Bible and has a parable party for the children every night. And what they do is they read little snippets of scripture, and then the children say, you know, Matthew 6:4, and he learns to do that too because he's very good at memorizing. But he's getting a little tired of hearing about how everything horrible that happens is God's will. And then one day the foster mother says, "Oh, Marcus, you're so lucky. You're going to live with your great aunt on an island in South Carolina."
And he's in Western North Carolina at that time.
Yeah. His guardian, is it ad litem or ad litem? Or do you say either one? Ad litem, thank you. I've been saying a different one each night. His ad litem, William, whom he likes very much. William got him in to see his mother in the morgue because that was important to him. Some people want to see their dead beloved. They want to see and just make sure, just check it out. So William takes him to the airport and they give each other the Spock blessing. And then Marcus gets on the plane, his first plane ride, and goes off to Myrtle Beach, where his aunt is waiting for him at the gate.
And they go for a lovely shrimp dinner, which Marcus promptly returns to the environment.
Yes, he learns immediately. She's a grave-looking woman. She doesn't look formidable, but she looks grave. And she speaks very seldom. She speaks when she has something to say. So she tells him, "The car will be less hot in a few minutes. Put your suitcases in the trunk." And they're in the car, and she says, "Are you hungry?" Pause. Do you like shrimp? Pause. I know a place where they will give you all the shrimp you can eat. And so they go there, and Marcus takes her up on it and has his first helping, second helping, and third helping. For one reason, because the waitress is so, reminds him of his mother, who's also been a waitress, and has that smile and has that teasing way with him. So he has his three helpings, and Aunt Charlotte has a tiny little salad, and she picks around the edges, and she has some wine. We're going to find out that's part of her life. And then they get in the car, start down the highway, and he throws up. It's much more dramatic if I'm reading it, because I pause and then I say, when I threw up in my aunt's car, and then blah, blah, blah. And she just says, don't worry. Most of it fell on the mat. And here's two kinds of, there's a spritzer water and a windshield wiper fluid, and here are two rags, and just clean it up, clean yourself up. And she goes out and stands looking at the traffic until he finishes. By then he's just humiliated and scared, because if she doesn't like him, back to foster care. She's his only living relative.
And so this puts a great deal of worry in him, and he starts to behave in such a way to win her favor and to be as little problem as possible. It's almost in a little bit like a child of an alcoholic who is always trying to manage.
Is that right?
Yeah, they try to do everything correctly to not inspire any outburst from the parent.
Oh, outburst. That's interesting. So he's narrating this whole book from later when he's an adult, but yet you get the feeling as you're reading that it's a child's mind too. And he says at the time that the first week or so, we were getting accustomed to each other, which meant making paths where we didn't run into each other. He wants her to stay as alone as possible so she won't feel, oh, why did I do this?
And she's very forthright with him, but she doesn't exactly share information with him either. So she does tell him about his mother's insurance policy, and she's very forthright about that. But anything else about her world, she pretty much keeps close to the vest.
Right. The first time they have their talk, she asks him into her studio, where she's got a huge painting which has a cloth over it. It's one of her bread and butter paintings, as she calls it. She paints things that she likes, but then she paints people's new mansions for a great deal more money. And she says, now, I just want to get all this straight. You're to stay with me if you want to till you go off to college. And I want you to know, I want it to all be straight between us, that as your guardian, I get a monthly stipend. And, of course, immediately he thinks, ah, she did it for the money. And yet that was just so Aunt Charlotte. She's so upfront. She's deeply troubled, but she's straightforward. And she's an honorable person.
And as you mentioned, she's a painter, and she does so commercially. She actually makes a living from it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like she was an artist from a young age. She came to it later in life. And even though she started off with a commercial eye in mind, mm-hmm. she has developed an artistic sense, and she does want to express things in her paintings.
30 years before, she had finally escaped her horrible childhood, her three husbands, extreme poverty, et cetera, et cetera. And she actually won a lottery. It wasn't very much, but it was $10,000. And it bought her a beach shack in another state as far away as she can get from her past three husbands. And she went there and she learned how to do carpentry, and she fixed up the shack and took long walks on the beach every morning and just thought, I'm free, I'm free, I'm free. Nobody's going to bother me again. And then at the far end of the beach, the north end, there was this, the oldest house. This is a beach community of about 200 years old. And the oldest house was built by a family who intended for their great, great, greats to come there. I mean, that was just part of it. They were thinking ahead. And it went on okay, this lovely house, until Hurricane Hazel, which was 50 years before the date of the summer of this book. And the summer of this book is 2004. And she walks up there every day. This place is now a ruin. It's going to fall down. It has fences all around it saying, keep out, caution. And, of course, he's 11 years old, and the first thing he does is crawl under and go and sit on this very rickety porch and have his lunch. Then he falls asleep. But back to Aunt Charlotte, he wouldn't have known anything about that house, except she said, I walked up to this place, they call it Grief Cottage, because during Hurricane Hazel, a family and their young son just disappeared, and nobody knows what happened, whether they were swept out to sea or what. And she said, this house was such a ruin, it reminded me of the ruin of my life. And so she said, I would walk up there every day and look at it and think about it. Then one day she went up there and she saw she couldn't tell at first whether it was a man or a woman in a hat and, you know, trousers and loose shirt. And this woman was painting Grief Cottage. She watched her. The woman was friendly. She was a tourist. And the woman said, yeah, I'm just an amateur, but I love this. Isn't this spooky? And Charlotte thought, you know, she's not capturing it. This place has a mood. She just decided, I can do that. So she went and got her paints. She got some books about landscape painting. She started to paint, and she painted this place over and over and over. I've tried to paint it over and over and over just to see. It's different every time. So the shadows are different. So he goes and sits on the porch of this place where he's not supposed to sit, with his back to the crumpled doorway, and he feels that feeling that we sometimes get when there's someone behind us who's just come in, and he does not dare to turn around. He just gets up from the porch. He, you know, falls through the sand. He crawls under the keep out signs and runs home. And that's his first feeling for the person he will come to know as what he calls him, Ghost Boy.
Now, when we spoke about your previous novel, Flora, you mentioned Turn of the Screw was a touchstone for that novel. And now in this book, you have an actual ghost that Marcus thinks he sees.
He sees him twice.
And also dreams play a big part in the story. And I think dreams and ghosts are super hard to do successfully in a book. So how do you approach those topics and not make a hash of it?
I guess I would do what Conrad said, immerse, immerse, immerse. I just immerse myself. I'm a great dreamer, a great nightmarer, if there's such a thing. I have seen a couple of ghosts. In fact, I wrote a piece about it in there's this online magazine every day called Lit Hub. And last week I wrote an article called Courting the Supernatural, in which I talk about that very thing. And she even let me use one of my drawings of one of the experiences I did have seeing a ghost, one of my two times in my life. So it's there with the drawing. It's colored pencils.
Now there's another ghost that's supposed to be on the island, a man in gray.
Yeah.
And Aunt Charlotte has no time for that.
I should mention, Aunt Charlotte has had three husbands. None of their last names were Lee. But when she moved to this island in South Carolina, she said, I think I'm going to start as an insider. And I'm going to name myself Lee, after General Lee. And the islanders are quite sure about this gray man. They call him the gray man. Actually, he's a real figure on Pawley's Island, and this is Isle of Palms. But some people say he's just gray, and some people say he's wearing a Confederate uniform. Some people say he's wearing a general's Confederate uniform. But before a hurricane, as it's whipping itself up, he appears, and he walks down the beach. If he looks at your house, you're okay. It'll still stand. If he doesn't, if he just walks on by, you know, you won't. And there was a painter before Aunt Charlotte came who painted, a professional painter who knew how to paint everything from art school. And he painted this ghost over and over again and then died. And his family is still making a fortune off of it. You can buy every kind of print. You can buy aluminum prints. You can buy things that look like they're on canvas. So that's the other ghost. And she has no time for it. You're right.
Now, something fabulous has happened on the beach just over the dunes. And a female loggerhead turtle has come and laid a clutch of eggs, over 100 small eggs there. And it seemed because there is a turtle squad that comes to help.
Yeah, now there's turtle squads. They get help to the sea, those little things.
Some people had forgotten to properly rake the sand after a volleyball game, and she thought she was laying eggs in a dune. She wasn't.
She was. They were playing volleyball, and she thought this big hump was the dune, and then there they were exposed the next day.
Through the kindness of the turtle squad, they relocate the eggs for her. And with this benign help, it's very much a parallel to Marcus and the benign help he has to rely on from adults that he's not necessarily known his entire life.
That's a good point. Thank you. That's a good point.
He wouldn't make it to the ocean of adulthood without the help of his personal turtle squad.
Yeah, that's very good.
Marcus is a very bright young man, and he talks with his aunt about her paintings, and he picks up these almost imperceptible emotions that she's layered into the clouds mm-hmm. in those paintings. But he's not so bright as to when she talks about her family life. And she had only met her niece, Marcus's mother, once before, and both she and Marcus's mother had moved out of the house at 16, and it was because of abuse from her father and Marcus's mother's grandfather. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't catch the word defiled. Mm-hmm. And so he's ignorant of why his aunt has such a visceral reaction to dredging up those memories.
Right. Right. His mother never talked about that either.
And so his aunt becomes furious in housework.
And he is a houseworker. I should add that Marcus is, he's intelligent. He's sensitive. He's a little bit weird. He's one of those people who he's overly empathetic. It's just very important to him to look at you and know what you're going to do and what you might need. And that's good sometimes, and it also can cause you a lot of pain.
There are not a lot of children on the island at this point. And so we flash back to Marcus's friendship with a boy named Weezer.
Weezer, yeah.
From his hometown. And Weezer wants a true. What are these truths that Weezer wants?
Yeah, Weezer's a great talker, or was, back in the days when they were friends. And Weezer says that a true, you have only a few truths in your life, or maybe one true, or maybe no truths. A true is someone you can always count on. Always count on.
And then simply. He's also desiring stories. He's a fiend for stories about fiends.
Weezer loves to hear gruesome, grueling stories. And so Marcus becomes an expert at pleasing Weezer. And actually, then when Marcus gathers the courage to go back every day to the grief cottage and sit with his back to the house, he tries to talk to that spirit and figure out which topics the spirit warms to and which he doesn't. And the spirit, if Marcus mentions anything about, well, you know, 50 years ago, you and your family probably were washed away. The ghost you just feel empty air. So he doesn't like those stories. But if Marcus says, I'm an orphan. My mother died in a car crash. Oh, the ghost comes back. Or if he says, there are 100 turtle eggs buried in the sand next to my aunt's house, and of those 100, so many will make it to the sea, and the rest won't. And the ghost loves that, a little more forward. And so this goes on and on.
And while he doesn't quite develop a friendship with the ghost,
no.
There is someone who becomes important in his life, and it's probably his Aunt Charlotte's best friend.
Lashicott Hayes.
And she keeps almost everyone in the world at arm's length, but that's the one person she can seem to tolerate, and he does become friends with Marcus as well.
Yes, and later in the book, Marcus asks Lashicott, who becomes sort of a father figure, how did you and my great aunt meet? And Lashicott says, well, you know, it's a small island, and we know when someone new has come to town. And actually, he met her in a hardware store, and she was trying to get the right kind of grout, and she mistook him for a salesman and said, "Do I really need this, or you know, can I get away with just that?" And he says, "I don't know, but I'll ask." And she's just humiliated, and she's just cold. She turns away and goes because she feels she's intruded. And then later, she works a lot of different jobs before she starts painting. And one is she works for a veterinarian. Lashikot comes in with his dearly beloved dog, a golden retriever, who is dying. And Lashikot is so impressed by, you know, he goes up to the desk to pay her, and he's holding back. He hopes he won't blubber. And she says, "Mr. Hayes, we know where you live. Why don't you just go home, and we'll see you again. We'll see you later." And then he comes back to get the dog's remains, and she's not there that day, but he sees her again, and she finds out he restores vintage cars, especially Bentleys and Rolls Royces. That was such fun to research, to look up these cars. She says to him, "I wish someone would teach me how to service my own car, because I don't like to depend on others." And he says, "Well, come and work for me and I'll teach you." So she goes and works for him, and they become good friends. And then he and she start a taxi service with Rolls Royces and Bentleys on the little island. And it goes very well. And then they sell out to somebody for a profit. And with the money, she's going to be free for a while. After that, she starts painting.
A silly story about the current Bentley company.
Oh, what?
They just released a new edition, and you can get a falconry kit built into your Bentley.
You mean the falconry?
Yeah, right. Because falconry is so big on the Arabian Peninsula.
So
many
know
customers
what?
For Bentleys come from the Arabian Peninsula that they have made a dedicated falconry model for the Bentleys.
Now, I listen to a lot of this facts and non-facts, but I had not heard that one.
Now, Lashikot had come from privilege. He came from a very wealthy family, and he chucked it to become a grease monkey, albeit a very high-toned grease monkey.
Mm-hmm. One of the first things he says to Marcus is, well, I can't do his accent, but, "I am not representative of my tribe." And he didn't just say, "I'm going to become a grease monkey." It's just that he hated his boarding schools. He was always cold. And so he would get kicked out so he could move further down to another boarding school that was warmer. Finally, he ended up at home.
I guess he started off in Phillips Exeter.
Somewhere like that, or Groton, way up there. It was cold. And then down he came. And he's been married 3 times. And when Marcus later says to Aunt Charlotte, "Did you leave them or did they leave you?" And she says, "Oh, they left him." He lets women walk all over him.
And she was kind enough to only walk over him just enough and, well, keep him at arm's length.
She more or less makes a little square the size of a handkerchief, and he can come in that square. But he knows this, and they're good friends. They've got each other's back. If anything happened to either one of them, they'd be there, as indeed he is when Aunt Charlotte falls over in a drunken stupor and breaks her wrist and breaks her ankle, and Lashikot can take over and get Marcus a bicycle so that Marcus can shop for the groceries, and it becomes a team effort.
And even though this is 2004, Marcus isn't really engaged in popular culture very much. His favorite movie is the Alec Guinness version of The Lady Killers from the early 60s.
That's right.
And he knows a little bit about Star Trek, but his aunt has a computer. He avoids using that. Most of his day, he has a route of going up to the grief cottage, checking on people, checking on the eggs.
No, first, he makes his bed. Actually, there's a book out now. I just saw it. It's by an admiral, and it just says, "First you make your bed." And everybody's giving it to boys for graduation. I had to put that in. First he makes his bed so that she won't think, "Oh, what a slacker. Why have I let him in?" And then he cleans the bathroom after he's used it. And only one time did he leave the seat up. And she said, well, it's, you know, I've got a man back in the house. So he's always careful never to do that again. Then he makes himself a little breakfast, and then he does the laundry, if there's any laundry to do. So he and then he mops the floor if the floor looks dirty in the kitchen. And then he goes out to his eggs to check on them and to check on the ghost boy.
And so he has this route, and he's very hyper-vigilant about it.
Yeah, it's all he has, yeah.
Now, at one point, we go back to when he was talking with Weezer, and a song by William Shatner comes up. And it's a strange bit that William Shatner should provide such a profound emotional moment for two 10-year-old boys. But it's for the song, It Hasn't Happened Yet. And I was just wondering, writing is so much making choices. What was it about that one song that you thought would appeal to these two boys?
Well, actually, it also appealed his mother. As she was driving home from work, from one of her three or four jobs, during the bad times, she heard this on the radio. Actually, you should listen to it on iTunes, just William Shatner. I think the song is called Has Been. And she loves every single word. She says, you know, that's what art can do. It can make you feel less sorry for yourself and feel that you're part of what everyone feels. And then Weezer also gives Marcus all the videotapes from Star Trek because they don't have
a DVD player. They have a next-door neighbor who hasn't been there when Marcus first moves in. She comes for the season. She's almost 100 years old.
Coral Upchurch.
She's as delightful as you would hope, but she is undertaking a journey of self-archaeology.
Yeah.
And it seems that so many of the characters in the book are undergoing this process of self-archaeology as well.
That's great. That's true. Go ahead.
Because Marcus has all the boxes from his and his mother's apartment to go through over the course of the summer.
Yeah, he's got those boxes that were packed up the night his ad litem came. And then the boxes were stored and sent to Aunt Charlotte, and they're in her garage. And she says, you know, open them as you feel you want to. I would imagine, I never say how many, but it's about 12 boxes. And they're just full of things that the social worker has gathered up and just thrown into the box. Marcus goes through and he thinks, why are the toothbrushes in with the books and the shoes? But he goes through and everything has a memory and a story. I try not to put too much in each box and say too much about each story, but...
And Aunt Charlotte, when she's talking about learning about painting and the books that she checked out of the library, yeah, she mentions the greats of landscape painting. But then she also mentions the German expressionist Emil Nolde. During the term of the Nazis, he was forbidden from painting because he was part of the degenerate artist.
Yeah, he was forbidden to paint at all.
And could you talk about his unpainted pictures and how that influenced?
She's very impressed by this. They let him stay in his country shack, just said, don't paint, don't draw, do not make art. And he was at his peak then. He was 70 years old. He'd finally made it to what he wanted to accomplish on canvas. So he couldn't use the oil because it would smell if they came to visit. So he used watercolors, and he got this, they call it Japan paper. I ordered some just to see what it's like, and it's wonderful to paint on. And he started painting these tiny pictures. They're about 4x6s so that you could get them away very quickly. And he called them my unpainted pictures. And these paintings, now you can get them. Aunt Charlotte couldn't have seen them in a book, but you can get them now. There's the unpainted pictures in a book, and they are something. They're nightmares. They're half people. They're the lower levels of the subconscious with brilliant, brilliant colors. Do look them up.
Because he was an expressionist, and the paintings of the expressionists did have vibrant colors.
That's right. He only had watercolors, and you know they're kind of thin, so he had to drip, 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 drip. He had to make layers to make them. They're quite something. They'll give you pleasure if you don't know his story, and they'll give you shivers if you do.
Could you tell us a little bit about your experience with painting?
Oh, my experience with painting. Just one more thing about Aunt Charlotte. She loves the English landscape painters, and she especially loves Constable, whom she calls the King of Skies. He does skies and clouds. Okay, for my art, to put a long story short, when I was about 15 or so, it was a toss-up. I wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to be a painter. But somehow, I became a writer. I didn't train in art. I'm not trained in art. But art has been my solace for different periods of my life. And like Aunt Charlotte, a time came when, it was November the 9th last year. And I woke up with such rage, and I was almost wordless to express what I wanted to express. And I started doing art again with colored pencils. And you can see them on my website if you like. And I now have a blog. It's more like a once-a-week essay on some topic that I feel is important, like old age or writing or God, something like that. I'm learning art again. And, you know, Google is such a great help. For instance, if I want to paint a Nold-like painting from the subconscious, and I want a woman in it, and I want a full-grown leopard, and I want her leaning on him, but also terrified that she's leaning on him, all I have to do is go to Google and look up leopard, and then look up images, and wait till I find one that has the profile that I need, and then I work it up, and I learn to draw it. The same thing happened a couple of weeks ago. I was writing my blog about, well, the second part was about Maya Angelou and my wonderful one day with her. I wanted to convey that day, and I looked at all these images, and I needed a side one because I was looking at her from the side because we were together posing for a horrible photographer who had wanted us all to wear hobo clothes. And that's how she and I met. She said, "I prefer to wear my mink coat." And then I said, "I think I'm going to wear my clothes too." And all the men put on hobo costumes. It was a photographer whose name I won't mention. And I wanted to illustrate this story of Maya, so I found a picture of her from the side. And as you know, she's got, her mouth is just like it's huge. And the smile is like nothing else. I don't know, there's a pride and a power and the hair. I got everything. I got the mink coat. I got the pearls. Then you have to know this. So we're sitting and talking, waiting for the photographer to get everyone set up. And Maya calls to one of the flunkies, and she said, "Could we have," I can't do her voice, it's deeper than God's, "could we have some orange juice and a bottle of champagne?" And we got it. So we she poured. So I had that in the picture. That's on the blog too. That's my art. I love my art. And oh, like Aunt Charlotte, when she starts learning to paint with her left hand, you just try it. You just try it. Just try to draw a line. And all these pictures that she draws are 4x6s. And all my drawings are 4x6s. That gives me a companionship with her. There's something about 4x6. It's doable. I turned in the book then, but I was still interested in my art. And I thought, well, I will see what I can do drawing the kind of pictures that Aunt Charlotte might draw when she is purging herself from the things she doesn't want to remember. And I started drawing, and I did discover that if you stick with it, you can get a great deal out of not being so in control. Much later in the book, when she's doing one of her recovery periods, she goes to this recovery villa, and she teaches drawing and painting with the non-dominant hand. These are all people trying to get sober, and she says to start, "The left hand will show you things that the right hand will never let you near," or vice versa if you're left-handed. So all this art has meant a great deal to me.
If there's one thing about the title of the book, it's missing one letter. And it's called The Grief Cottage, but it should be called The Grief Cottages. because there are at least three houses on this island that are dealing with grief in very real ways.
How true. Should grief cause you to live somewhere else? Yeah, there's Aunt Charlotte. We know something now about her grief and Marcus' grief. And then there's Coral Upchurch, who's actually 95. Her husband has been dead for a long, long time because she was much younger than he was. And her son has died a few years back. He was in his 60s. He died of actually just having his pacemaker changed. So he's gone. And every year when he would visit, she still prepares for him. She and her caregiver, they get his room ready. They get the green vase. They get the right flowers. They make the bourbon and prune cake that he likes. And she goes totally through with it. But she's also thinking, now I have nothing left to lose, and what would be me if I was not Coral Upchurch, if I was nobody's mother, nobody's wife, I was on no committees, I was nothing. And she's trying to get down to that, and she tells Marcus at one point, well, I got down to the dirt, and then I started digging in the dirt, and all I found in the dirt was, I thought I would find my jewels and things, really jewels, old things. And she said, and all that was at the bottom was love, and just the love that I never really gave enough to anybody of, and it's just love down there. And he says, well, you know, that's not such a bad thing to have love down there at the bottom. So they school each other.
And she's trying to also get to that place before she had a name. What is it of herself that is unnamed? Is such an important concept to her.
What is important to her that is unnamed? Right. She says, I've gotten beyond the Upchurch, I've gotten beyond the Coral. And she says, but I still know that when I'm, you know, rolled into the undertakers for the work, they're going to say, well, this is Mrs. Upchurch. But that's what she wants. What's below the me? My agent, who's a dear fellow, Moses Cardona, he said, I want to try to do that, to do archaeology on myself. And I said, well, you better watch out, because it's a process.
Well, and your last two novels have been archaeology of selves for the main characters, because Helen in Flora was in advanced years when she was looking back on this episode of her childhood.
Yeah.
We have Marcus, we're guessing, in his young adulthood.
Young adulthood, late 20s, early 30s.
Looking back on his childhood. And so this concept of people looking back at their childhoods has been a strong one in your recent fiction.
Right, and there's a tiny little detail that maybe nobody notices, but in Flora, the book Flora, there is a scene where Flora, the caregiver, and Helen, the child, the girl, this is 1945, so they don't watch things, they listen to things, so they're listening to a suspense program every Tuesday night, and they love this. They curl up on the sofa with their feet up and wait to be scared. So the first week I wrote out what it was that they experienced, because I remembered this horrible little story from a program like that in my childhood. And these programs were 30 minutes. 15 minutes were commercial, so what does that leave? There was background music that somehow didn't go with the story. And so the first story was one I'd heard about a little girl and her mother, and they're in a department store. It's full of holes, the plot. And the little girl gets lost, and so the mother has to leave the store for the night. Now, you know, today there would be lockdown. There would be nothing like that. But in this radio thing, there was. So they close down for the night. The little girl is left there with all the mannequins, and the mannequins come out, and they greet her, and they befriend her, and they say, you know, if you come and join us, you know, you'll never be sad again. You'll always belong. And the next day, the mother comes, music, wrong music, wrong music. And the mother says, that mannequin looks like my daughter. Okay, that's that one. So then I had to make up one for them to watch the next week. And I had this idea from a long time ago about a boy who goes to have to live with maybe grandparents or some cold people for the summer at the beach. He has lots of time on his hand, and he goes for a walk every day, and he meets this couple sitting on the porch. So in the radio program, this couple are dead, and they're in a burnt-down house. So he meets them, but he doesn't think anything of that. And they welcome him every day, and they say they're waiting there because they're waiting for their son to come back. That radio program that I created led into this.
Because the porch had burned on the grief cottage at the north of the
island. Oh, yeah, the porch had burned. But the rest of the house was sort of intact. And when I did that house, when he finally goes inside with the real estate man, that research was so much fun. I'm going next, after Asheville, to Pawleys Island, where there are two people from the Southern Historical Society. They were just such a great help. I had blueprints. I had every kind of description I needed of houses that were built in the late 1700s. And so Marcus does get to see the inside of this house.
Do you find yourself that you can't write until you have those details down?
I do more and more. You know, I remember, maybe this is when it started, this was some years ago, I was reading a novel by a well-known writer, well-celebrated, and it got to the point where someone said, well, I was reading Kierkegaard in the original Norwegian. You know, it ruined it for me. And the same with the cars. You know, Carrie and I, on our book tour, we stayed overnight in this lovely little inn, and there was a car show in town. And I was lucky enough to sit next to some men who were talking. They know what they're talking about. So you don't write about old Bentleys. And then this, a woman wrote, of course she wouldn't know. So you have to get it right. You have to get it right.
I have to ask you, is there another project you're working on right now?
Well, I was working on one, and then during this trip I now seem to have two. But they balance each other in such a way that I can do one. That's my normal, acceptable, guaranteed approval one, which is another novel, second book contract. And then there's another, which is a great secret, and it's just made for me. I can do that away from the computer. I can do it in a notebook. I can draw it.
Gail, thank you so much for spending some time with us this evening. It's very much been a pleasure.
It's a pleasure to see you and talk to you again. Thank you for being with me today.
Well, thank you.
Gail Godwin is the author of The Grief Cottage, which is published by Bloomsbury. A special thanks to Karen Hayes, Ann Patchett, and Nikki Kaufman at Parnassus Books in Nashville for inviting me to speak with Ms. Godwin at their wonderful store. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.